Welcome to On the Mic Podcast. This is your host, Tim Drake. On today's episode, I have percussionist Danny Taylor. I was so excited to get Danny on the show, as you've kind of heard me tease leading up to this. Danny and I are actually cousins. And I don't know the genealogical math on this. I tried to figure it out at the beginning of the episode, and I think I had it totally off. We're either third cousins or second cousins once removed. None of that explains it to me, really. Danny did his best to attempt it, and I still don't know that I understand. But it was so great to get Danny on the show. We had the most ridiculous bullshit Hollywood meetup that we could have asked for. Our families just so much were so intent on making sure that we got to know each other, since we both kind of work within the same industry. And yeah, it was fun. It was fun to finally meet him a couple years ago, and then to really sit down and talk and learn more about his backstory. He has such an incredible story. He's been playing drums pretty much his entire life. He comes from a very entertainment-based family, and yeah, it was just so cool learning his story, learning about how he and his wife met on a touring Broadway show, and yeah, just how he got to the point in his career where he went from just playing drums to small community theater to being a percussionist on Broadway. Such an incredible story, and really a story of just somebody who was determined to be able to make a career and did everything they could to be able to have the career that they wanted. And it was just so much fun. And you know, I love hearing stories like this, and some people might roll their eyes and be like, oh, so you got your cousin on the show. Again, this is really only our second time sitting down and talking, and of course we did it on a podcast because this is Los Angeles. And it was just so much fun learning his story and learning, you know, what his method is to being able to learn drums, and how sitting down and just sight reading music to get ready to perform, you know, for a live audience, that is so incredibly stressful to me. Of course, I come from a music background and could never even attempt to do the things that Danny does. It is so incredibly impressive. And yeah, just so much fun learning his story. Of course, I had to talk to him. My mom has always been very set on Danny has the story about how all these Broadway shows, even here in Los Angeles, all the different studios and stuff, softball is a big thing. And Danny was on the team for In the Heights when Lin-Manuel Miranda was part of it. And it was one of the things when I had told my mom, you know, I'm going to have Danny on the show. She's like, oh, you got to talk to him about playing softball with Lin-Manuel Miranda. And so we definitely touched on that to find out, you know, what that was like. But yeah, this was just a really fun episode to sit down and talk and catch up and learn more about his story and just everything that drives him and gets him to continue to perform. He, at this point too, he's a dad, and so being on the road is not something he really cares to do anymore. And we talked about, you know, making those life adjustments to having a family and still being able to play, you know, with touring Broadway companies when he gets those opportunities. But yeah, it was a really, really fun chat with him. Hope you guys really enjoy this episode and learn just as much as you can about Danny. I will have all the links on the website where you can follow him and find out more about his story, find out any of the shows that he might be performing. Mostly now it is all in Los Angeles, since again, he does have a family, but still has performed on a number of shows out here when the touring companies come on through. But I hope you guys enjoy this episode. Stay tuned next week. Mike Mazzalotti is joining me again on the show. Mike was on the show almost 6 years ago with Billy Anderson when they were touring the Gateway Show in Salt Lake City, a great stand-up show that Billy Anderson still to this day hosts. Mike has continued to just generate tons of interest. He opened a great comedy space out here called Third Wheel Comedy. And yeah, I wanted to talk to him about that, how everything has come together over the last 7 years. Both of us were getting ready to move to Los Angeles at the time that we recorded the last podcast episode, the good 7.5 years ago since he was on. So yeah, I wanted to make sure that we were able to talk about that, kind of catch up. Mike also had a brand new book come out about his experience in comedy called Comedy is for Dummies. So I wanted to find out more about that. He had a Dry Bar Comedy special release over the last little bit. So yeah, we had a lot of things to catch up on and talk about, but I think you guys are really going to enjoy that episode with Mike Mazzalotti, so stay tuned for that coming up here. But a huge thanks again to Danny Taylor for taking the time to come on the show, talk about his career. Just, again, such an incredible story. It was so much fun being able to talk with him and catch up and get to know each other a little bit better. So I hope you guys enjoy this episode, and we will see you guys next week. So, yeah,
yeah, it's good to see. I haven't seen you since we ran into each other at Warner Brothers.
Yeah. That was a while ago now, a couple of years.
Yeah, it's
Year two?
yeah, it really has been at least a year and a half or so. Like the time has just flown by, and it doesn't seem like it. Like it truly seems like it was just the other day, but
I know.
yeah, it's been about a year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah, nuts. Time flies.
I've told many people the story of our first meeting being at the Eastwood scoring stage, and it's the most cliche bullshit Hollywood family meeting that could happen of
Seriously.
both sides of our family. So I had to do the math on it today, the genealogical math, I guess is what it would
Oh,
be.
yeah.
So we would be third cousins that had somehow never crossed paths, but everybody was convinced we had.
Right.
And then when I got saying, no, I don't, I've never met Danny, and then
Yeah.
everybody was like, you two need to meet. And then how else do we do it but on one of the most historic movie studio lots in the world? It's
Exactly.
yeah, it was how it was meant to be.
Yep. Doesn't get much more Hollywood than that.
So if I have it right, so your mom is my dad's cousin,
Yes.
and so you're his second cousin, and then we are third cousins then, if I have done that math correctly.
I always thought, let's see, if they're first, I thought we would be second cousins. I think like they're first cousins, and then we're second cousins, and like then you start getting into the once removed thing. Because like I think your dad and I are first cousins once removed. I think that's how it
Maybe
works. It's always
that is
confusing.
how it works. 23andMe will sponsor this and we will find out. That'll
Perfect.
be the way that we get to the bottom of this.
Yes. Nice.
Now, part of the reason too that we had never met until then is I, of course, grew up in Utah. You grew up out this way, if I'm mistaken. And I always knew your grandma, Edith. Like
Yeah,
she'd come out to Utah and I would see her. And somehow I never ever thought, there might be more to that side of the family. Like there I might have people out in California.
oh yeah.
And yeah, it just never clicked. I mean, even going into my senior year of high school, there's somebody else along that side of the family that lived literally down the street from us.
No way.
And Edith's brother, who's my grandpa, came up to me after a football game. Like the weekend after a football game, I was like, yeah, those kids at Bingham really, really gave you guys a run for your money. And he's like, Grandpa, I go to Bingham. And he's like, oh, you go to high school with two of your cousins. And I was like, what? And one of them had been one of my weightlifting partners for like the past like few years.
Get out.
And
Oh,
the
man.
other I was friends with as one of the cheerleaders at the school. And yeah, we had no idea. And then it was very awkward on Monday to be like, so we're all related, huh? It felt like some like weird incestuous cult that we were somehow. But I mean, that's Utah in a nutshell. So
Well, the families are so big, like
yeah.
it's bound to happen.
So, I mean, did it feel like it's as big of a family for you living out, like growing up out here, as compared to what we were hit with in Utah?
I'm sure it wasn't nearly the same as how you guys grew up, but I definitely always knew I had a huge family in Utah.
Yeah.
I'd be coming up for family reunions and like going to Uncle Marvin's house. And it's my one of my dad's favorite stories is the first time he went up to meet the family was at Thanksgiving, and he sat in the middle of the table and realized you never sit in the middle of a table at a family that big, because all you're doing is passing plates left and right. You never get to eat.
What's crazy too is you going up there for Thanksgiving, and we always went there for Thanksgiving, and so even more so, that's what's so
I know.
granted, I usually head out back and fed the goats, so
Totally. I haven't. There was a horse too, right?
yeah, there were a couple of horses.
Yeah.
This is starting to really sound like a whole new like Beverly Hills hillbilly that we're
strike some black gold.
So, but yeah, I mean, despite us having such a big family, you know, growing up in California, your side of the family has always been a lot more kind of focused in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I always knew, you know, my great aunt or my great aunt Edith is doing, you know, she's in different movies here and there, and everybody would always point her out in the background of things. Oh, there's Edith. There
yep.
she is. And then to find out you know, your mom does stuff, and then as I started to find out about you, you know, work, you know, touring on with Broadway, and it was just so fascinating to me that I was like, oh, my people were there all along.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I never realized that there was this. How was that being in such a musical family growing up? How long did it take for you to kind of get that bug, or were you truly just born into it?
I was definitely born into it. You know, I grew up around it all the time. My dad was an actor. My mom has her theater degree. I think I was on stage the first time when I was three, A Christmas Carol. There's actually a picture, maybe I can send it to you, of us doing Christmas Carol, and it's three generations on stage because it's my mom, dad, grandma, and me. We were all on stage together. But yeah, I just kind of grew up in the theater, grew up in entertainment. My dad was a self-taught drummer, and so I was always around bands with him. And yeah, I really had no choice. I had to go into entertainment.
See, you at least got the push. I got the, oh, really? That's the career path? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was, yeah, I was very fortunate that I had the support to go down this road.
Yeah, I remember telling my parents when I was starting Second City that was the career path. And I remember my mom distinctly saying, "You're not Martin Short." And I was like, "Yeah, Martin Short wasn't Martin Short." Like, until.
Exactly.
And I'll never be Martin Short. I am not that talented.
Don't tell yourself short.
But it's funny to like just kind of be born into that and to always kind of have that in just your peripherals even. Was drumming just kind of the natural thing? I know you said how your dad was a self-taught drummer, or was acting. Where did it first kind of ping for you?
Mostly acting was kind of the first thing. Like I got into professional acting as a kid. I didn't do a lot. I had like a commercial and a TV show, like one episode, a few AFI films. So it was definitely acting from the beginning, and kind of acting up through high school. In high school, I did a little bit of everything. I did sports, acting, and music. Musically, yes, I started playing pretty early, like 4 or 5, I think. I mean, playing. I mean, I had two sticks in my hand making noise, yeah. Basically. And my parents got me into lessons when I was about 7, and I was not ready for it at that point. You know, I didn't want to practice, didn't want to, you know, I just want to go out and play sports and all that kind of stuff. So it was still kind of self-taught. You know, I was very lucky. I had got to have a drum set in my room from as long as I can remember. So I could always just kind of jam out and do my own thing. When I was about 10, we tried lessons again, and this time it stuck. But my parents found an amazing teacher. It's a guy named Fred Petrie, who was a studio musician for a long time. He did like all the Hanna-Barbera stuff, played with Joey Heatherton, Stan Kenton, a bunch of big band, you know, legends. And so he taught me, he trained me to be a hired gun, basically. Like almost all of my lessons were always rudiments on a practice pad and learning how to read. You know, in an hour long lesson, I've maybe spent 10 minutes on the actual drum set. So he really set kind of the fundamentals for me, and gave me the tools to apply to any style of music, which I've always been very grateful for. Because even now, I'm still not really a band guy. I get frustrated, you know, sitting in rehearsals listening to, you know, guitar players talk about what chords they want to play next. And I take that back. I am in a band now that I very much enjoy, but for a long time, I would much prefer, you know, give me the charts ahead of time or let me sight read them. Let's do one rehearsal, do the gig, and move on to the next thing. That's just kind of what I was trained to do. And it's kind of what when I went to college, I went to Cal State Northridge for percussion performance. that's also kind of how they trained me, and all of us there too, was basically to have the tools you needed to apply to anything that you could encounter.
And see, that's always something I envy with drummers, is having that just strict adherence to it. I mean, I came from a guitar family, so much was learning that, but I always was so fascinated with drums. And I remember going to a scout camp, and they had this, it's like a foot long, just like wooden dowel, but like it was supposed to be part of like a fire starting kit.
Okay.
I got two of those, and I would try to learn rhythms on my thighs, because I couldn't have a drum kit at home. And so at night I would have my headphones in and was just sitting there trying to figure out rhythms. And now, as I've kind of gotten back into it a little, I realized I did not know how to figure out rhythm properly. But I would just my legs would just go red trying to figure this out, because I didn't even have a practice pad. So I would always envy, I would see the kids at school with their practice pads and everything, and it was just so cool to always watch like the kids growing up. And yeah, I was that guitar player that was never that good, but could always be like, man, this chord would sound sick right here. So I know that all my drummers probably always resented me.
That's okay. All the guitar players get annoyed at us at sound check when we have to play a bass drum for 10 minutes.
So, or any time during a sound check, and you've got the guy that's just like, floor tom, and you just have the drummer just over. And So now, you mentioned the commercial that you did. Do you remember what that commercial was that you had done?
I do very vividly, and unfortunately, it never actually aired. Which I was it's oh. funny after the day, I actually thought it was my fault. It was a cereal that back in the day was called Triple Cereal. It was kind of like Rice Krispies, but the commercials were all about doing a triple take after you ate the cereal. And so you'd eat the cereal and then, you know, look three times at the cereal box, and then in post they would speed it up to go poop, poop, poop. And so the scene I was in, it was me and another girl my age, I think I'm 9 or 10 for this, and then a horse. And they were trying to get the horse to do the triple take. They brought in like 2 or 3 different horses, and they're just going to get the horse to do it. And I remember we, like, the morning session was fine, and then we went and had lunch, and I started running around like crazy after lunch, and I got an awful stomach ache. So we came back after lunch, and like I was not performing my best. Yeah, so like I was convinced like my stomach ache and my poor performance was the reason the commercial never aired. But then I found out that the product just got taken offline.
were you know, as a kid actor, and they're having you pretend to eat the cereal, were you actually eating the cereal, and was that what was making you sick running around?
You know, it could be. It definitely very well could have been the case.
I know when we were shooting Bundy Manor, there was a scene where they're eating ice cream, and our young actress Alara continually kept eating ice cream.
Oh man. Yeah.
It's always made me laugh when I see either a young actor or like background who's never really done that.
Yeah.
And like they're making themselves sick the whole time.
Yeah, seriously.
So now you mentioned the drumming teacher was a session work guy. Mm-hmm. And kind of taught you that kind, that focus on it, even at a young age, learning under that kind of teaching. Did you ever expect yourself to be a studio musician at all?
It's funny, from a very early age, my goal was to play Broadway. Like that was my intent. I mean, I can remember, you know, going to see community theater shows and saying like, that's what I want to do. And it's funny, growing up in LA, you know, these some of the best musicians in the world, you know, play here. And it was pretty intimidating for me growing up around that. And, you know, I definitely had some confidence issues as to whether or not I could, you know, hang with them and play at their level. Because there's also sight reading. You know, when you're doing a movie score, you're sight reading it. You very rarely have the music in front of, you know, ahead of time, unless it's something that's crazy hard. But you're almost always sight reading on the spot. And I was a little nervous that my sight reading wouldn't be up to par. And honestly, I loved theater. So while, you know, the session work is great and it's a very nice payday, I definitely always wanted to do theater, just because I loved the theater side of it. So that was my goal from very early on.
That's really cool. A lot of people, especially really young, are not thinking about the people there in the pit. They're not thinking about where the music is coming from. They hear it, and I mean you're hidden.
Right,
that's really cool that you were focused on.
Yeah, and more they're hiding the orchestra pits even more, which we're always trying to fight against. But they're constantly trying to, sound designers are trying to box us in to control the sound more in the house. If they can put us in the back room, that means they can sell more seats in the front row. So there's always a battle to keep live music for the theaters, at least, into people's eyes and minds that, we're down there.
Yeah, it's I've enjoyed some of the Broadway shows I've gone to where they've actually had like a band on the stage, where it's
Yeah,
not your
yeah.
traditional pit type of sound, and you're getting to watch, just live music, and it's almost like just having a concert, while this incredible show goes on in front of you. So I personally am always a fan of, more live music and not having it just hidden, in any
Yes.
show.
Yeah, totally.
So you mentioned too with doing like movie scores, how you're sight reading it right off the bat. The more that I've learned as I've had the opportunity to spend time within the Eastwood scoring stage, and learning about so many of the way that the session musicians come through, it is just stunning to me. You mentioned the level of talent that you sit down, you're sight reading it, and to find out that a lot of the times, they have it at like the second take.
Oh
And
yeah.
how does that, what is that process like when, I mean, there's people that you've never played with before. You've got, these massive orchestras. How does that process happen when you get everybody, to come together that quickly?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I have not done a ton of scoring sessions, so I'm definitely not an expert on the subject, but I can definitely tell you what I've observed and what I've experienced, at least percussion wise. As far as playing with people, it's a very small group of people that do almost every movie score you've ever heard, especially the percussionists. There's maybe a dozen or so that just kind of do everything, so everyone's very familiar with each other. Everyone knows what each other's strengths and weaknesses are. There's always a section leader or a principal percussion, and they decide how to divvy out the parts on who's going to play what. And while there is, differences, it is kind of the same pool of people. So you do see the same players on the sessions pretty often. So you know how to play with each other. And every once in a while, there's a little, that first take or that first, red light of the day there. You are feeling each other out. You're feeling out the conductor. What is it? Is the conductor just up there to, communicate? Are they actually giving you some emotion? Where do they want the beat? Is it, are they going with the orchestral delay, which drives me bonkers? Do you know what the orchestral delay is?
I don't think I do.
So almost always there's a lot of conductors, a lot of orchestras that, if this is your pattern, a lot of musicians play on the upbeat. So they'll be da, 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 da. So they're playing when the hand comes up. Drives me nuts as a drummer. So you because for me it's like there's a downbeat, it's down one, play, play, play. But every conductor feels it differently, so it's the orchestra has to learn where the conductor is feeling it, so we're all playing together. Some Every once in a while, if a conductor is really hard to read, the eyes go down and you just play with your stand partner. Look up to get your start and use your ears from there on, then on out. And it's also almost everything's on a click, so everyone's on headphones, so you always have a click in your ears, for the majority of things.
So, have you ever, in the few that you've done, found it at all distracting, where you've got this giant screen behind you that they're playing the movie on? And I at least me as a cinephile, I would always want to be turning my head to be like, what's
I mean,
I can't imagine having to not pay any attention to that.
right. I mean, you are technically there to do a job, so you've got to stay focused. And the way they set us up, it's movies in the back behind you, so you do have to focus on the conductor and look forward. Sometimes on playback, you can turn around and get a glimpse of what's happening, but almost always it's just focusing on the music.
Yeah, that I had heard a story of a conductor at one point that when people would try to take a peek, who would yell out, "If you want to see the movie, pay at the box office like everybody else." And just right back to it. So
Yeah.
it's such a cool a cool experience, I can imagine. I mean, I get the little peeks into the scoring stage usually when they're setting up for something. It's such a wild experience inside those places that one of these days I'm hoping that they'll let me sit in on something just to observe. But I mean, there's the NDAs and everything, and that scoring stage was so busy with such high profile projects that it's like I'm lucky the few days that we get to stumble in there. So now for
It's a cool spot.
Broadway, it's so hard, especially being out here on the West Coast, to get to New York and to find roots there. How did that process begin after you've gone through all this schooling, to be within percussion, to get to New York to start finding your way into the orchestras? How did that begin, and what was that first the first show you got onto?
It all starts back when I was a young child. No. When I was about 15, I started playing community theater out here in LA, and then I started playing more and more regional shows, kind of like the non-union regional shows, like Fullerton Civic Light Opera, which doesn't exist anymore, Musical Theater West, a couple others out here, and I met an MD doing one of the shows there. Who ended up hiring me for a whole bunch of stuff. And then he got a tour and asked me to go on that tour, which I was 100% ready to go. Like, I love touring. And so that was a bus and truck non-union tour, because every city you've never wanted to go to. I think I say that, but it really was an amazing experience. It's a hard life, and it is definitely a young person's life. Because you are in a new city every night. You ride the bus all day, do the show at night, sleep in a questionable hotel, and then back, rinse and repeat. But actually, I met my now wife on that first tour. We did Man of La Mancha. I was in the pit, and she was on stage as the housekeeper. So that made it a little easier to be on the road. And then I started working on the crew. For the first show, Man of La Mancha, I worked on the crew as the pit rat. So it was my job to set up the orchestra pit in every city we went to. And then the second show was Gypsy. And I started that one on the cast bus, but it's a large ensemble. And so the bus was very crowded. In addition to the kids that are in the show, each kid had a parent, and those kids and had to go to school every day at the back of the bus, which means the bus had to be quiet. So you were on a silent bus for, 5, 6, 7 hours a day, getting city to city while the kids went to school. And so I did a couple months of that situation and was not enjoying things. So I ended up kind of creating a position for myself on the crew as like a swing tech. And eventually I ended up like doing all the rigging to put our proscenium in the air, doing all the helping put all the electrics in the air, helping put the sets together. So that got me onto the crew bus, which meant it's a sleeper bus, which meant you slept through the night. You knew kind of what to expect. You weren't going bouncing hotel to hotel. It made for long days, but it was a made the best of the situation. And I enjoyed it. I liked to be on the crew bus, and I learned a lot that I still, the things I learned doing that crew work, I still use today. So my wife is from New York. She grew up on Long Island. And so after that Gypsy tour, I had decided I was going to make a go of it in New York. At least I would have, some kind of home base with her family there. And so I made plans to move there in the summer. And about a month before I was planning to move, the MD that got me my first tour got an off-Broadway show and asked me to come along with that. So I was very fortunate that I actually got to move to the city with a show.
Yeah, that's incredible.
That's pretty rare. And sometimes it doesn't work out. There are people that have come to town with the show and can't find anything after that and end up going home. But it was a show called The Marvelous Wonderettes, which is a like 50s, 60s jukebox musical. And it was fun. It was my first studio album, which I got to play on, which was fun. I'm on the cast album for that. And so that was a non-union off-Broadway show. And one of the way it works is you're allowed to sub out your off-Broadway show to go sub on a Broadway show if you have that opportunity. So when I moved to town with the show, I started emailing everybody, all the drummers and percussionists in the shows, that I'm in town, I'd love to sub for you. Most responses are, "That's great, my sub list is full, but you can come watch." So then I would end up, going through all the shows, sitting in the pit, getting to know people, watching how it's done, listening to all these amazing players and learning, just so much from every show I would sit in. And then eventually I got to socially be friends with one of the percussionists at In the Heights. And something happened where his sub list opened up and he got a spot. And he brought me on. He'd never actually heard me play, or he took my word for it that I could do it. And he worked with me a lot on it because there's some rhythms in there that I had never played before, and he really helped me out. And so my first Broadway show that I subbed on was In the Heights, and it was absolutely terrifying. It's probably one of the scariest things I've ever done. Because when you sub on a Broadway show, it's or off Broadway, you don't get rehearsal. The first time you ever play the show, you're playing a show. It's you can go sit in the pit and watch as many times as you want. You get the music ahead of time. You can get recordings. You can get videos of the conductor. So you have plenty of material to prepare for. But the first time that you ever actually are playing with the band, you're playing a show. And it's scary, and especially a show like In the Heights. It was so beloved and like had such an amazing band and such an amazing music team, and just an incredible show all around. It was kind of heightened, like beyond being my first Broadway show, it was also like In the
How
Heights.
far into its run was it when you got to sub in?
I think I started actually something just came up on my memories that it was around April, so I think I did get to do a few shows with Lynn before he left. So I think they're maybe a year in by the time I started
That's still
doing
pretty fresh though. That's like right when it starts to pop is usually like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine the stress level at that point.
Oh, yeah. Like the first thing that happens is like there it's a recording that starts and it's got, the clave rhythm. And then there's a point where the recording drops out and she's playing clave live. And like you just gotta be so solid with what you're playing because like the whole band is listening to where you're at. And I remember my wife and a friend of ours came to see the show my first time playing, and we all went out for a drink afterwards, and like I was just comatose. I couldn't speak. I was drained. And subbing is just, it's very scary. It's there's so much there's so many unknowns going into it. Luckily, it got more comfortable for me as I did it more often. But yeah, it was tough.
I mean, one of my biggest takeaways from that, I mean, I hope anybody listening, because I mean, a lot of the times as people listen to the show, they're always wondering, how do what moves do I make to get into these kind of positions? And I think one of the biggest takeaways, really, is kind of the hustle and the grind there. And I mean, things have changed, over even just the last 5 years of how that works. But one of the biggest things is that you were always trying to put yourself in that position, and you were ready for that moment. And I always feel like that's kind of a continual theme, is just being ready for that moment to hit. But even like you said on Gypsy, like trying to make sure that okay, I can do this. I can make myself available here. Whether you're rigging stuff up, whether any way that you can be useful. I know as I've talked to different executives and been like, how did you get here? What did you do? All of them were like, make your like almost be a pain in the ass to just make sure that like people know who you are, they know your name, and so that when that moment comes, and that's really exactly what
Oh
you.
yeah, that's exactly how to do it. I mean, that's how I started conducting too. I taught myself how to conduct a show, and an opportunity came up, and I was able to do it. But yeah, when I got to New York, like there was a thing called Thirsty Thursdays, which every Thursday night all the Broadway musicians would go out for a drink after the show. So I made sure I was always there. Also, I played in the Broadway Softball League. I mean, I love playing softball, so that was the bonus. But that was also a networking thing. But yeah, it was really just about emailing everybody, getting my face out there, going to the hangs, going, socially, physically being there. I feel like that's still a value, is to physically be places. I know we're such a social media centric society now. But I just there's so much value in physically meeting with someone face to face and being able to talk. Back, when you talk to the generation before me, they would cold call. They would have to, call people on the phone, and every once in a while you'd get some kind of rude response. It's like, ah, don't bother me, kid, go away. But by the time I was doing my hustle, it was I joined the union, because when you join the union, you get a full contact list of every player in town and what show they're on, and so it made it really easy to go find people. And so I did all mine through email. I'd imagine if I was doing it again today, it'd probably be DMs through Instagram, for those that are on. And yeah, I mean, people have become so much more accessible now.
Yeah.
It makes it very easy to reach out to people. But yeah, just trying to make the personal connection. It's assumed that if you're reaching out to somebody to do something, that you can do the thing that you're reaching out to do. But it's that added step that will get you hired of, do I like you? Do I want to hang out with you when we're not doing that thing that you're going to
Yeah.
do? So that's always kind of.
One thing within that too, I mean, you mentioned like some of those early shows being non-union. A lot, I mean, especially with one of the other podcasts that I do, we covered a lot during the strikes of talking about, what these kind of things mean. Especially, when you're coming up, you have to earn those hours. You have to kind of earn your keep to be able to get those union positions. And some of the stuff you talked about with Gypsy, it's a little easier to kind of get those things. As non-union, because once you're union, everybody does have a specific job, and so you can't do somebody else's job. But now, while that sounds petty to some people, it's job security. So, but it also makes sure that all of us earn our pension, that we all get our fair shake, our proper rest. But I think one of the big things that you kind of hit on there, and I was just explaining this to somebody the other day, is that when it comes to that time and you get into the union and you get that contact list, is that with any one of the unions, they're always taking care of their union members first. And so it is a very important thing, whether you're working as a percussionist, whether you're working as an actor, a writer, director, anything that's encompassed by one of these unions, it is very important to find a way to get in there, because it does open the doors dramatically.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
From where you can, where you start off at.
Yeah, for sure. I'm definitely super pro union. There's so many benefits to it of taking care of the players and the people that are involved, and yeah, definitely go union.
So now you slightly touched on one thing that when I'd mentioned to my mom over the weekend on her birthday that I was going to be talking to you this week. She immediately was like, "You need Danny to talk to you about playing softball with Lin-Manuel Miranda." Like that was her big thing of, "You need him to tell you about that." The floor is yours.
Thank you. He didn't play that often. I feel like he only came out to like one or two games. But he was great. I mean, he is a man of the people, as they say. Like, he is just as nice as you see him on, on TV and everything. He is that nice. He's so generous. He's so giving. Like, just amazing guy. And then, not really softball related, but the MD that he works with quite a bit is a guy named Alec Blackmore, who's the same way. Just incredibly gifted, talented people that are also so kind and so nice and so giving. They've created an amazing team over there. But yeah, softball with Lin was fun the couple times he came out. The whole soft Broadway softball thing is a interesting vibe. Like, Heights was the first one I played on, and then the next season I played on a show called Wonderland. I played on the Phantom of the Opera team 1 year. I remember 1 year there, Nick Jonas was doing a show. I think he was doing How to Succeed, and he was playing on the team. And like, they had to have security out because people would find out he was there, and just
Yeah.
mobs of people. So that was always interesting.
Yeah, that's got to be weird to be in a situation like that where it's like, yeah, you're just going to the ballpark on a Wednesday night and you've got Lin-Manuel Miranda or you've got Nick Jonas or
Right.
yeah. Like,
Yep.
I can only imagine how, like, yeah, you're not expecting like the star of the show is gonna
No.
show up. I mean, unless it's Bette Midler and she tries to slide into home.
Yeah, right.
Anybody who didn't get that, it's a classic Seinfeld reference. So for Del Rochelle, the musical.
Yes.
So as In the Heights, how long did you spend within the Heights?
Let's see. So I started, I don't know, maybe a year. Actually, I have to look back. I actually auditioned to do the tour of In the Heights because they were sending out a tour. And this is another amazing, like, kind moment. Auditioned for the tour. I didn't get it. I was blown away because the MD, Alex, who's very busy, high up, high ranking person in the theater land, actually took time to call me and say, you know, we're not going to use you for the tour. We love everything you're doing in New York, but it's nothing that you're playing. We're just going to go in a different direction. And you never get a rejection call. Like, you, if you don't get it, you just don't hear anything.
Yeah.
And so, like, to have that, you know, that closure and that kindness of him telling me, you know, at least, you know, what the reasoning was amazing. But having auditioned for that tour, and I'm assuming getting a good report back to the contractor. But that's the other thing about theater, is there's a musical contractor, and the contractor is responsible to hire all the musicians. So you ultimately want to get on the contractors list. There's only, it's probably three or four main contractors in New York right now. There's only a couple out here in LA. So they're the people you want to be on their list. And at the time, the contractor for In the Heights was Michael Keller. And he called me and said, I need a replacement for the Legally Blonde tour to play drums. Do you want to do it? I said, yeah. And I had to go audition for it. The audition was just me playing with the music supervisor in a room. The music supervisor would play piano and I played drums. I had to go find the music myself. Luckily, because of my networking, I had, like, nobody, like, they, you really have to do the legwork yourself. Because of the networking, I had met one of the subs who was subbing on the show or had subbed on the show. And I was able to connect with him, and he gave me his book. And so I was, you know, able to take his book and the cast recording, kind of put it all together, what they were looking for, and took that book with me to the audition. And the supervisor gave me the okay and sent me off to the road.
That's incredible. You're literally just piecing it together.
Yeah.
Good. I can do
basically.
It.
That it. And then that Legally Blonde tour is definitely up there with one of the hardest things I ever did. We only traveled three players. It was the conductor who played keys, our associate conductor who also played keys, and myself playing drums. And every city we went to, we got a local orchestra. It's pretty common to pick up some kind of local musicians, but it's incredibly tough to do that many local musicians. Because you do one rehearsal on Tuesday morning, and then you open Tuesday night. So there's not a lot of room for, you know, fixing things if players aren't prepared. And for me, that was one of my big learning moments, is that show was on a click for almost the entire show, and clicked very precisely to the point of, like, it's going on at like 91 BPM. Click's going to come out while I do a drum fill. It's going to come back at 92. And the MD was very particular about me playing right on the click, and you know, just bearing what they call bearing the click, meaning you're so perfectly in sync with it that you don't hear the click. And I struggled with that because I, again, kind of coming up through the theater world, a lot of theater music, and it's you're accompanying, so there is some give and take to it. And also coming up through theater, I kind of had a very give and take sense of time. So to, like, perfectly lock into a click and sometimes ignore what I was hearing was very difficult, because, you know, the local players didn't know the show that well. So they were looking to me as the drummer to make sure that I locked into the click to be the kind of their foundation. And it was something I really struggled with for a few months. And, I got in and, did a lot of shedding, you know, practiced a ton with the click. It was also a very hard-hitting show, and I was not a hard-hitting player, so I ended up taking some lessons with the drummer that I had replaced, or with the teacher that had taught the drummer that I replaced. And taught me, there's a technique called the Mueller technique, which is all about, you know, whipping your hands so you can get a bigger sound without working too hard. And so I learned that and was able to apply that, and my playing grew immensely from that experience. While it was tough, it was definitely, it was just a very tough time for probably 4 or 5 months. But eventually we got to where we were all happy, and the MD and I are still good friends, and my playing really got to a much higher level. So one of those tough times that really you can decide if it's going to defeat you or decide if you're going to beat it. And I defeated it.
And to really help those that are not musically inclined to really understand, when you're talking about two playing to a click and getting used to that, a click track, especially when you're doing any of this, it's not just like a basic metronome. It's in your headphones or in your in-ears. And having something like that and an in-ear monitor or headphones is one of the most distract. It is so off-putting that I cannot imagine having to do that on a live performance.
It's so funny. I've done it so much now that I've just gotten so accustomed to it, and now it just is, it's become another instrument to me. But yeah, getting used to it took some time.
When I was managing bands way back in the day, and I would go into studio with them from time to time, that was the only way I learned how to even listen properly when we were working on tracks. And it as soon as I would test it out, put it into like an in-ear, I was just like, oh, that, like, you're trying to get anything. Like, it amazed me the precision and the talent you had to have to be able to capture that. So when you're talking about it going from like a 91 and then you come back in and it's at a 90, like, that is so incredibly difficult. I would have thrown in the towel. I'm like, no, you're making me count more than my brain is going to allow.
Probably the hardest thing from that show was for those that are familiar with the show, there's the Legally Blonde reprise, I guess, just to check. Second act, and so it goes from like a slow kind of Irish jig at about 91 BPM. Over about 30 measures, it speeds up and speeds up and speeds up until you're back into the full groove at like 120. So the click would drop out for that speed up, and then we'd have to meet that new tempo at the end. And learning how to do that was very difficult.
That's incredible. So as you wrap up Legally Blonde, how did things start progressing to allow you to do like Aladdin and start finding your way into some of these other big touring Broadway shows?
Yeah, so I finished Legally Blonde, came back to New York, started subbing. I started subbing on Sister Act. I was also subbed on a show called Allegiance. I was playing percussion on Sister Act and Allegiance. I was playing drum set. And for Sister Act, that was again a player I knew and had gotten to know socially, and he needed a sub. And I learned the book and got into it. And so when the tour was getting ready to start for Sister Act, my wife auditioned for it and was cast in it. So then I talked to the music director, who was the music director of Broadway, was going to be the music director of the tour. And so I talked to him. I said, my wife just got cast, or my girlfriend at the time just got cast. I'd love to go out if I can. And then I talked to the contractor as well, saying, gave them the situation. And they were able to work it out to where I got to go out and travel.
Oh, that's awesome.
With the tour, yeah. So we got to do that tour together, which was amazing. That's the tour that I started conducting on. It was a key three book plus conducting. Key three was mostly like extra, woodwinds that we didn't have, like gray sax and bassoon, a couple electric keyboard things. And that was another thing of, put your best foot forward and do everything you can to put yourself out there. So the MD helped me a little bit with the conducting, but I mostly taught myself. And then there became a time when he was going to have to leave to do a workshop of a show for a couple weeks. So the associate conductor was going to conduct, and we'd have a sub for the piano player. Oh no, we didn't have a sub. It was just the associate conductor was going to conduct, and we had a vacation swing playing keys. And so I was not supposed to conduct at all. I was the emergency worst case scenario. If everything goes absolutely wrong, we'll put Danny up. And sure enough, one of our keyboard players slipped on the ice, broke his arm. And after many discussions, everyone thought the best thing to do is to take our regular associate, put him back in the pit with two keyboards to cover as many of the keyboards as he could, and put me on the podium to conduct it. And so that's how I started conducting. And then they gave me a few more chances to do it. And then I actually did the last couple of months as the associate conductor of Sister Act. And so then that musical director then went on to do Hunchback of Notre Dame, which was a Disney production. We did La Jolla and Paper Mill, and then a cast album. And so he brought me along with those as well. So that's how I got to Hunchback. And then again, the same MD got Aladdin and brought me along on Aladdin. And again, because I can conduct a sister act, he put me on as the third conductor. I started as the third conductor and then moved to the associate for a little while and then back to the third conductor just as personnel changed.
So as you're moving up through these, going from these small non-unions into just bigger and bigger and bigger shows, the position within the pit and growing within there still has some bit of kind of homeostasis to it. But the level of the shows, did that ever kind of add any enhancement to the intimidation, to go from, something smaller levels, Gypsy, then to flying carpets and the Pantages.
Right. It's funny. My mom has asked me that same question, and for me, at least, also because when you're playing drums percussion, often you're kind of like secluded, either behind a cage or oftentimes in another room. It does. You don't really feel the grandeur of the show when you're down in your own world. Like you're with the orchestra and you're playing, with them, but we never get to see the stage. Aladdin, I did have a stage monitor, so I could see a little bit. But you don't really get to feel, how big the show is because you're also very focused on just what you're doing. It wasn't until I started conducting Aladdin I was like, whoa,
Yeah.
this is massive. we went through tech and we got to see all the special effects and everything that we were doing. But when I got to conduct it, I remember both the MD and the associate conductor said at the end of Friend Like Me, just put your head down. It's gonna be too bright. Because there's pyrotechnics that are flying. It's like, I can't be that bad. So sure enough, like they start going off and you're conducting blind for a couple of minutes because it's so bright. But yeah, it's funny. As I've gotten older and more experienced, I think my level of expectations has grown, not only of myself, but like of the people I play with. So I definitely got I think in that sense, you start to feel how, the quality of the show that you're doing, is that there's just a level of expectations of how you play and how everyone should play together. There was that MD that I was working with. His boss is a music supervisor that works a lot with Alan Menken, and I think in early on in the MD's career. They were talking about Disney, and it's like with Disney, you're not trying to live up to the gold standard. You are the gold standard.
Right.
So, like, expectations are high, and you expect a lot, and you expect as close to perfection as you can get, because you are setting the bar.
Yeah, there's songs that everybody knows. A beat is off and a note is off. A whole audience is like, hang on a second. That's
Yep,
not
yep, yep.
the right way for a whole new world. What are
Right,
you
right.
doing?
Exactly.
So that earlier too, we were talking about, as a session musician, kind of feeling out the conductor. So now on the opposite side of that, being the conductor, do you have anything that you do to try to give that back to the musicians to let them be able to kind of have that comfort with you and to be able to know how you're going to handle it?
I definitely, yeah. And every orchestra plays a little bit different too. That's one thing about touring and picking up new musicians in every city is every orchestra reacts a little different. And so, at least for me when I was conducting, I would have to have a little give and take and kind of learn where they were responding. If I got too far behind the stick, I would say something. But usually the regular MD had already conducted several shows by the time I was up. So he'd already kind of learned what was expected of where we wanted them to place the beat. But yeah, I always want them to feel comfortable. Every time I'd go up, I would make a joke. I would take two batons and say, because I'm a drummer, I'm more comfortable with two. So just choose whichever one you want to watch. So it just kind of breaks the ice for everybody. And also for me, it was brought to my attention early on that I look very angry when I was conducting, and it's mostly because my concentrating face just looks angry, and my brow is down and I'm very focused. So I had to make a conscious effort to make sure that I was, emoting with my face and not just the body. 'Cause The thing about conducting theater is that you're almost always conducting to a camera. You're not necessarily conducting the orchestra because every player has a TV screen of that camera that's looking at you. So it's kind of like conducting on Zoom. You know, you can only conduct as far as the screen will allow you to, and you get much more personal shot of the conductor's face. So whatever the conductor is expressing is kind of magnified into that screen. So I had to really stay conscious of emoting and making sure that I didn't scare anybody. And the MD that I worked with really did amazing work with me. I was just always so grateful for what he did to kind of mentor me in my conducting, because first time I got up, you know, I was what they call band directing, you know, both arms are doing the same thing. And he's like, why are you doing that? There's only one beat. You only need one hand. And so, you just move to one beat, and then that lets your other hand, you know, do all the shaping and, you know, cueing people and all that kind of stuff while you're still conducting, and just kind of refines it and makes it clearer for the players.
So now, as you mentioned, when it comes to being part of these touring shows and stuff, that very much is a young man's game. I know from my past doing any type of tour stuff, yeah, I don't care at all to necessarily be out on the road doing anything anymore. I'm like, I'm cool. I can drive 10 miles and I'm happy where I'm at. Now being a father, like having a family, you know, what have you done to kind of pivot now to kind of reinvent what you're doing with your career?
Yeah. So, I love touring. I absolutely love touring life. You know, I can say that I've worked in every state and country. You know, it was amazing. You know, the sights I've been able to see were incredible. But as our son was being born, I started, you know, looking at other career paths, and you know, freelancing to a scary world
yes,
to begin
is.
With, and then yeah, another mouth to feed, and it gets even scarier. And so on Aladdin, I had started producing benefit events for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, and it really kind of sparked my interest in producing. So even before the pandemic hit, I was starting to shift my focus into producing, and I really wanted to produce themed entertainment. I love theme parks. I played the Terminator in a stunt show for years at Universal Studios. So it's like I kind of wanted to take like this leadership producing side of me and this, you know, theme park side and see how I could meld them together. My hope was that, you know, I could ride the Disney train and say, hey, I was just on Aladdin. Can I go work at the theme parks? And then the world shut down. And so I actually hadn't planned on playing anymore. I was going to get myself out of music and try to go down this this more 9-to-5 path. And so during the pandemic, I actually got a job at Netflix as their safety coordinator for all the scoring sessions. That's when I saw you at Eastwood, was working that job. And so that got me a good taste of the corporate world. And then after that job, I joined a thing called the TEA, which is the Themed Entertainment Association. Excuse me. And so that's, again, another networking group. I just started going to those, and I go to all their networking sessions. I go to their webinars, start meeting people, start volunteering. I volunteered at all everywhere I could go to get my face out there. You know, I even now where I'm integrated into that group pretty well, I still, you know, take the first shift of every check-in just so I can, you know, have my face out there and meet new people coming into the industry. It's such a great way to just continue the network and expand it. And so through one of those networking sessions, I actually met who I work for now, which is a company called Beaudry Interactive. And so we do interactive experience design. And so I'm a coordinator for them right now and doing a little bit of like project management and that kind of stuff. And then playing wise, you know, I said I wasn't going to play anymore. And then as touring started to happen again, there were shows that were coming through LA. And I got a call one day to say, hey, there's a show down in Orange County. The drummer just got COVID. Can you be here tonight to play it? Oh, I was like, and I was a little out of practice and I was very hesitant to say yes, but I figured even being out of practice, it was going to be better than, you know, not having a drummer for the show.
Yeah.
So the show was Tootsie, which I actually didn't know all that well.
And such a fun show.
Yeah. So I didn't really know it. So I got in the car and I turned on the album and listened to the album on the way down. I got almost to the end by the time I got there. Then got in, looked at the music, had about a half an hour with the MD, and then sight read the show that night. it went surprisingly well. Almost the whole show was on a click, which is nice because I didn't have to worry about watching the conductor as much. I could just, you know, use my ears. And just the charts were written pretty clearly. And it actually, the drummer that had gotten sick was the drummer from Sister Act. So he and I were already friends. So I kind of knew how he played. And I had subbed for him on the drum set book of Sister Act. So I could kind of cop his feel. So I did that. And then I can't remember how soon it was after that, but it happened again up here in LA. The drummer for Pretty Woman got COVID. Same thing. Can you be here tonight to play the show? And so I got there and turned out it was a false positive. So I ended up just watching the show, which thank goodness I did, because later in the week, he really did get COVID. And then they called me in to play the show. Still with only like, you know, a half hour with the MD. And that one was even probably one of the most difficult things I've ever done. It was an electronic kit, which is fine. A lot of shows use electronic kits. But the drummer was also triggering all the Ableton tracks, which is all the backing tracks and all the click tracks. That's also tied into the lighting and like sort of the home base for the whole show. But the thing about the way it was triggered is it was always triggered on a different pad. It wasn't just like, here's your start button. It was like, sometimes it's a pad over here. Sometimes it's your left foot. Sometimes it's your right foot. Sometimes it comes in after the guitar player plays 2 eighth notes and you come in on the third eighth note. And just the way it was written and laid out was, after I did it a couple times, I got the hang of it, but to initially look at it was sort of mind boggling. Again, it went well.
Not to mention that show too was at the Dolby Theater.
Yes. Yeah. That was at the Dolby.
Yeah. So massive venue here.
Yeah. I think the only big major mistake I made was, I missed a trigger, and so there's a section of that song that goes between like a kind of 80s electro dance beat and into an opera section, and so the drum beat went like a bar into the opera section, but I don't know if anybody noticed.
So I think I remember you posting about that, and it was like a week after we had seen Pretty
Woman. Yeah. Oh, like, yeah.
Yeah, we barely missed it. I was like, oh, it would have been fun to see it with you down there playing.
Yeah. But yeah, so I had those opportunities, and that kind of sparked, you know, kind of reminded me that I do really love playing still. And I'm very fortunate the contractor that works a lot of theaters here likes me and gives me a call every once in a while. So I just got to do the Wiz at the Fantages during their pre-Broadway run. I think they're actually about to open. They're in previews now, but I think they're going to open in New York very soon. So that was great to be a part of. But yeah,
it's cool too that, you know, as you meet your wife on only your second show, that, you know, you guys, how long did you date before getting married? I mean, having to go through so many touring shows.
My wife always lets me know that it was 7 years until we got engaged. it was kind of, we went through every possible scenario you can go through. We toured together. We, toured apart. You know, when I was doing tours, she was doing other tours and other regional theaters. We've lived with both sets of parents. We've lived on the West Coast, on the East Coast, like every possible living situation you can think of. And I'm so grateful for video calls, like for FaceTime and all that kind of stuff, because like when I was on Gypsy, it was phone calls, you know, and it was hard. I remember that the early days, it was very tough. You know, being able to at least have video has really made a difference when we had to be apart.
It's so helpful too, though, to have a partner who understands the lifestyle and understands the industry. Like there's no way even I could do the things I do if my wife didn't understand it and get it. And I mean,
oh yeah,
now she works at the studio as well, so it makes it even easier. Now,
Totally, totally.
but it can be such a hard grinding thing that many relationships can struggle to survive, especially on a touring schedule. So it's so incredible that you guys, have not only been able to get married, but to start a family, and that it all started off from being together on a touring show.
And I mean, when I got Aladdin, we actually made the decision that she was going to come out on tour with me, in hopes of getting pregnant, and we succeeded, yay. But then we actually, but like going through her pregnancy while I was on the road, like she did the first half of her pregnancy with her parents on the East Coast, and I would, oh no, the first half was on the West Coast with my parents, so she was living with my parents by herself. And I love my parents, but that's a lot to live with your in-laws. I love my in-laws too. Don't want to say anything. It's different. But finding different doctors and all that kind of stuff. And the first half, the tour was mostly on the West Coast, so I would go visit her. And then the second half of her pregnancy, Aladdin was mostly on the East Coast. Like we were in Washington, D.C. for I think 2 months, so I was able to like drive up on my days off to see her in New York. And then took a few weeks off when our son was born, and then he was on the road with us when he was 3 months.
He's already a road veteran.
Oh yeah. My mom got him a gift for his first birthday. It's this painting's got his feet on it, and it's got every city he's been in his
That's
first
awesome.
year.
That's really cool.
And then and I mean, and even my wife had to pivot when we started kind of dabbling in voiceovers for being on the road with me. And then when the pandemic hit, she got a little deeper into it and has had quite a bit of success. You can see in the back, she's got a full on vocal booth now. We went from the PVC pipe and blankets to that bad boy. It's really nice to, if we get frustrated with our son, we can just go in there and yell. But yeah, no, it's, I mean, she's had a lot of success with that, and just another way you kind of pivot to keep going.
It's I think one of the coolest things about this industry is that, sometimes people think that you've got this little teeny window and then you just age out. And it's like it can be that way, but it's definitely fun to be able to find the ways to reinvent yourself and to find the other ways that those passions can grow. And it really comes down to start, like I said earlier, where you were getting your hands dirty and anything you can, it starts to spark other ideas of, oh, I could do this. Oh, I can do this. I mean, there's areas that I'm even looking to kind of pivot to do some extra work now that, I never thought I'd work in certain areas. And it's like, oh no, I didn't realize this was as much fun and as rewarding as it is. It's like, it's one of those things I like wearing a lot of hats and
Absolutely,
keeping
absolutely.
fun.
It's like doing what I'm doing now. It's been a little weird because I'm essentially in a entry level position. And I'm in my 40s, but it's one of those things where it's like it's a stepping stone. And I love the industry and I love the work I'm doing. I can definitely see myself like moving up in that industry and having some good success. Cross fingers.
Well, Danny, I'm glad that we were finally, able to connect a few years ago after all the family pushing that it was so important that we connected. And to finally be able to catch up, in a recorded manner. This is for posterity. This is a So, but where can people follow you if they want to, find more of what you're doing?
Instagram, Red Danny Taylor, Facebook for all the anybody that still does Facebook. I haven't gone to TikTok route yet. Instagram is probably the best. Red Danny Taylor. That's the most up-to-date stuff.
Awesome. So, well, Danny, thank you so much for taking the time, especially later at night. So, I wanted to make sure that we could work this with your schedule because I definitely wanted you to be a part of this. So,
No, no worries. Thank you so much for asking me to be on. It's awesome. I love it.
well, hopefully we'll catch up a little bit sooner again than a couple years. And it's one of those weird things where it's like, We're like 20 minutes apart. Like,
I know, it's crazy. I know. I know. I barely see my mom, and she's so close.
I have friends that moved out here like 6 months after I did that live probably 6 miles away from me that I see once a year maybe just because it's because we're all so busy. I mean, even my producing partner who I now talk to and see every, almost every week, but it took 5 years before we were like, why haven't we done anything together since we moved out here? Like, it's
Know.
a weird thing, and it's slightly pathetic on all of our parts, but life finds a way. So,
Yes.
so awesome. Well, thank you so much, Danny.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, we'll talk soon.